This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Rochelle Unreich, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you, Cheryl. I'm excited to be here.
I think I got that accent right at the end of the word.
Perfect.
Yeah. I am hopeless with accents, but anyway, there you go. Welcome, welcome. There's so much I want to know about you, and I think we have a lot in common. Yes, we do. So firstly, I'm going to introduce you, and then I want to really talk to you about your career and how you came to write this book. Rochelle has lived in New York, Los Angeles, Sydney, and Melbourne. She has been a journalist for 38 years, winning cover stories for The Age, Harper's Bazaar, Marie Claire, Rolling Stone, which are all quite diverse, I might add, and others, and has had regular columns in the Sydney Morning Herald, The Herald Sun, and Elle magazine. Her work has appeared extensively in Australia, the US, UK, and Southeast Asia. She's here to talk about her book, A Brilliant Life, which weaves together the past and the present to capture the powerful connection between a mother and child. Very powerful story, and particularly powerful at this moment in time. But I want to go back to all those places I love, New York. I used to do I was on a home swap site years ago now, and I used to swap with this Australian woman who I've never met, but we did it for years. I'd live in her apartment in New York at Williamsburg, and she'd come and live at my place at Petersham. And we would kind of cross over, like she'd be flying to me where I'd be flying to my place and I'd be flying to hers. So I loved my time there. LA, I've been to many times. And of course, I love Melbourne and live in Sydney. There you go.
I love all those places too. And New York is like still a person I fell in love with and dear in my heart.
Yeah, it is like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Once you're there and you live there, it really gets into your system.
So tell me about your journey to writing, to being a journalist.
So I started writing when I was studying arts law at Monash University, not at all expecting to write. And one day I'd been on a trip to New York. I had jet lag, and at night I wrote a piece just to get over jet lag. I sent it off to The Age and they published it.
Oh, wow. What was it?
It was a sort of a humorous piece on America in response to an American comedian writing the same on Australia. It ran with my photo on a full page. And so suddenly I had this established writing career. I kept doing my law degree, but by the end of that, I had a full-time writing career going because I kept submitting stuff. My mother, who I write about in my book, was so nervous that I would give up my law degree.
Yeah.
So I remember when I got excited about my first article, she said, and I'll put on her accent, she said, "A bird in the hand is worth more than a cow on the roof." I don't know what that meant. I think it meant not to get carried away.
Yeah. Did you ever practice law?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I don't think what I realized was I did law after I saw And Justice for All with Al Pacino. And my aspirations should have been to write that film rather than be a lawyer.
I love that book. I think I'll watch that again now that you brought that up.
I don't, and I moved to Los Angeles to study part of my law degree and also study screenwriting and writing. And from there, I just worked both in the film industry and in writing and never looked back.
And what was your upbringing like? Tell me about how your family came to Melbourne.
So my parents both emigrated here separately after the Holocaust. My father came in the early 50s and my mother in the late 50s. It was my mother's second marriage and they met here. They were both originally from Czechoslovakia and found love here with each other. Mm-hmm. I loved Australia. They both individually just thought Australia was such a haven. They were passionate about it in every way, from mother, from the produce to the landscape to the people. Mm. They really felt at home here.
Mm, particularly Melbourne, I think. Like, I think, you know, Sydney is more, and particularly back then, would have been more city-like than Melbourne was in a way.
Because my mother came from Paris at that point, where she loved the big lights and the city and the fashion. But I think she just felt Melbourne was so comforting. Mm. And in actual fact, Australia had a large proportion of Holocaust survivors, the largest per capita outside of Israel. So they had a lot of friends who'd been through the same thing as them, and I think that helped, my mother particularly.
It's interesting how that happens with immigration, because that happened with my parents too. The reason why they came to Sydney is because other people in their villages had come to Sydney. You know, other Lebanese people had come here. And I think that, you know, when you're in that, like, complete unknown, where am I going? What am I doing? It is really important to find community. It's really interesting. And I'm sure there'd be a similar story with your parents. Like, when my parents came, they came and went, but when they finally came, there was a man called Antoine Andluffet, and he owned a butcher in Redfern. And upstairs in the butcher was a room, just one room, big room, and a bathroom. And he used to give it to families when they first arrived to live there until they find their feet. And we were there, six children and two adults in one room, one bathroom and one kitchenette, for a year before my parents found a place to live. It's extraordinary, incredible. Isn't it? They were incredible, weren't they?
Well, you know, this is a book about connections and the weird connections in the world. And I lived above a butchery belonging to a woman who saved my mother in Auschwitz when I lived in Sydney. She's in my book. Her name is Edith Rose, and her family had a butchery, and I lived in their little studio apartment in that.
Where was that?
In Sydney, in Bondi.
Where about? Wow.
Yeah, it's not there anymore, and I come from butchery roots too.
There you go.
But that just, there's so much, I think, when you sit down and talk to a person. Isn't it incredible, the endless connections you find and the way you relate and the themes that resonate in your life together?
Yeah. It's so interesting, isn't it? So you have this amazing career. I'm not going to say had, because I reckon you're probably still writing. Is that right?
Well, let's say journalism right this second, but I have written a few articles for the book. But I'd hate to give up both, really.
Yeah. So tell me when you decided to start writing long form, and was this memoir the first attempt?
Yeah. So I think when I started getting published at 20, I thought one day it's important that I write my mother Mira's story. But I started getting, at the beginning, I didn't want to do it just then. My brother had been a book publisher in Australia. He was one of the independent book publishers with Outback Press. And so I grew up really revering books, and I didn't want my name on a book if it wasn't the most excellent work I could do. So I put it off for a while, but then also somewhere along the way I told myself that I couldn't write a book. People used to ask, when is your book coming out? And I hated the question so much, it felt like pressure, that I started saying, oh, I don't know if I have a book in me. I didn't really believe that, but I started saying it. And eventually I did believe that. Mm. I just realized how important that, not to sort of do that negative self-talk, is. It started getting, as I got older, and especially after my mother passed away, and I know you'll understand this, I had nowhere to put that grief that I felt, that feeling of immense loss. And what I related to was words. When I read other people's words, when I'd read Patrimony by Philip Roth, I loved that story of his ailing father. Mm. When I read A Very Easy Death by Simone de Beauvoir, words meant so much to me, and I wanted to commit mine to paper. Mm. But COVID gave me an opportunity, but I still kept writing and discarding and not quite sure I could do it. And then one day I went for a walk with my neighbour, Diana, who was in my 5-kilometre radius. It was lockdown number 6. And I was complaining about journalism, you know, all my work's dried up. I don't know when I'll write again. And I said, oh, and by the way, I also want to write my mother's story. And she stopped me in the street and she said, isn't that what your legacy should be? And I really thought hard about that word legacy and what it meant, not just for me, but for my mother, my mother's legacy, and the fact that her experiences might die with her. And the next morning I got up and I sat at my computer and I started writing. I left at midnight that night and I did exactly the same 7 days a week for 6 weeks. And at the end of that, I had a draft.
Yeah, wow.
And it was like something was propelling me. Like I really felt, and I don't want to impose my belief system on anyone else, but I felt like my mother's hand was beneath me, helping me on this.
So when did your mum die? Remind me.
Almost 7 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. And mine died one and a half years ago. Yeah. It's so, and I've talked about this before, losing any parent I think is so formative, right? We didn't really grow up with my father. He left very early on in the piece. But losing a mother, whether you have both parents or you're just a single parent, is so, losing a father is incredibly sad, but losing your mother, I think, changes the course of your life. Now, I used to think, if you were young and you lost your mum, like if you were 10 or 15, because I know many people that have, or 18 or 16, that is so life-changing, right? Oh. But I didn't think at the age of, I can't remember how I was, 57 maybe, I didn't think that would be the same at 57, and I don't know how old you were when you lost your mum. But again, I feel that it had the same impact. It was so life-changing in terms of identity.
Well, and I think of two things. One is, as you say, we're sort of trained in society to think that once a person's lived a good life, we say they've had good endings. But I always think of something Stephen Colbert said when his mother died, and he said she was 91, and I might get it slightly wrong, but he said, I know it may sound greedy to want more days with a person who lived so long, but the fact that my mother was 91 does not diminish. It only magnifies the enormity of the room whose door has now quietly shut. And I think that sense of impact really spoke to me. One of the things that somebody said to me, which is in the book, which was the most profound words of condolence, was so simple. They said, "Mother is mother." And we all know what a mother means. A mother is somebody who nurtures us, who loves us, who champions us. You don't need to describe who they are because it's inherent in that title. So if you lose a mother, mother is mother. There's no further explanation needed. It's so deep.
Do you know, years ago I worked with this woman and she told me that she'd lost her parents and she felt like an orphan. And I thought, oh, that's so weird. She has children. She has a husband. Why would she feel like an orphan? Well, I now know. I know the feeling. I know the unanchored feeling. And really, I mean, you know, 18 months on and 7 years on for you, I'm finding my own way, but it's still a new way.
It did take me, I felt, about 3 years to really get myself out of that hole. And the thing that helped me most was when I thought about how Jewish people, what they say when you lose somebody, and they say, "May their memory be a blessing." And what that means is that when the person's no longer on this earth to carry out their good deeds, you stand as a person living, you stand in their stead and you carry out the good deeds that they would have done. And therefore their memory does become an actual blessing. And I think the way you speak about your mother, and I know you've brought me so much joy when you speak about her on the podcast, that really helps. I've looked up what your mother looks like. I have created a picture in my head of how she was and how she fed people. And that does inform me when I entertain people. I think of my mother. I think of your mother. I think of baking things. You know, just conjuring up who a person is so important.
It is really so important. I'm not sure if I've told this story, but I'm gonna tell you, and then we're going to talk about your mum. Years ago, and you know, you know this, like, you know, my relationship with her was up and down because I was fiery, I was feisty, I broke a lot of ground that my older sisters didn't. Like, they were always so good, but I was probably the rebel. I mean, and that's low, you know, I mean, I did hardly anything, but compared to my sisters, I was probably a bit troublesome for her. But anyway, I remember walking through, we were living in Marrickville, and I walked through St. Bridget's Church. She was Maronite Catholic, but she also, that was her local church, and she was deeply religious. She went to Mass every single day. That's certainly something that hasn't been passed down to me. But anyway, I remember walking through and they were having like a fete and they had all this food out and they had a stall, a Lebanese food stall. So I went up and, you know, and I was with a friend and I'm like, wow, this food's fantastic. It tastes just like my mother's. And we're eating and we're buying it and walking home. And anyway, when I told her, I said, oh, you know, you should go up to St. Bridget's. They've got this fantastic Lebanese food stall. And she said, yes, well, I supplied all the food. So I was eating her food. And I love that story about her because she had a finger in so many pies. You know, she's always doing stuff. And that's a really lovely memory I have of her. Of course it's her food. Why didn't I even think of that?
And aren't recipes incredible to bring a person to life? There's such a tangible way to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really interesting. Now, get me back on track, but I'll tell you this last one. I was in San Francisco, and as you probably know, I spent a lot of time there, and I was reading a New Yorker, a hard copy New Yorker, so it was a few years ago, and it was this journalist saying that she walked into an Indian restaurant and had an Indian meal, and it made her think about, I don't know whether it was her mother or her aunt, but she, you know, she really recognized the food tasted familiar to her, blah, blah, blah. Went home and just like, you know, oh my God, that was sensational. And it tasted like food from home. And of course, a few days later, she realized it was her mother's sister's restaurant. Mm. And I think that flavor even transcends in family. Do you think that?
Absolutely. I know that in our family, we get together for our Friday night dinners and we cook my mother's recipes, which my nephew lovingly did by her side and got them all down while she was living.
Oh,
and
wow.
It really brings, there's something visceral about the smells and the tastes of your childhood and of your past. It's like smelling a scarf filled with perfume of the person you loved.
It is absolutely like that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I was in hospital when they had to clear my mum's house out recently because they sold it and I couldn't be there, you know, which was a huge loss to me, but, you know, it had to be done and my sisters had to move forward with it. But the only thing I wanted from that house, the only thing I wanted is she had this green plastic bowl and a pink plastic bowl because they never had much and they never needed much to cook a feast. Unlike me, I've got everything. And she used to just, those bowls only ever came out Good Friday when she used to make these little donut balls. And I had started videoing them over the years when Instagram came about. And I realized that it was the same apparatus. It was the same like green bowl, same pink bowl, same. And, you know, that's all I wanted.
Yeah. So those memories fold into each other, I think. And
don't
every
they?
Time you do that, you think of those times.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Now tell me about her life and tell me, I feel that for you, it would have been hard writing it in her absence. Did you feel that maybe you wished you'd written it while she was still there? Tell me about those feelings because it would have been so many.
I do because of even, you know, I took real pains to fact check it and to verify everything. And there are some things I had to leave out because I didn't have her description. And so I wished I could say, what did that barracuda look for? But it was... There was joy in writing it as well. So I would say there were really, really difficult bits. Her story was, there were parts of it that are so grim. She was in 4 concentration camps, including Auschwitz.
Talk to me about that. Did you have an understanding of that when you were little?
I don't remember ever not knowing about it, but she spoke about her time in a really matter-of-fact way and didn't dwell on it. So I've heard from people recently who've known me all my life and didn't know she was in camps because it just didn't come up unless you saw her tattoo. But I had heard her testimonies and I thought there were certain stories that I knew really well. What was so interesting was that I sat down with her in the last 6 months of her illness to not really ask her what happened to her, but really find out, who are you as a person? How did you become such a positive, vibrant human despite everything you've gone through? What were your values? What did you want in life? And that was really the eye-opener for me. That's what I learned. And through that, I also learned about her experiences too. So it was a really nuanced conversation.
So you were aware growing up that she had been in a concentration camp?
Very aware. Look, I didn't have any of my grandparents. All four of my grandparents had been killed. So you ask those questions very early on and you find out. And I'd learned things about the Holocaust at school, but she was pretty open about her experiences. And, that was something we spoke about when asked.
And could she speak about them, you know, with frankness? How was it that she told the stories to you?
I often wondered about that when I wrote it because she told the stories in a very similar way. So part of me thinks that she told them in a way to protect herself. You know, when you've got a traumatic story and you know the details you share, there is a protection around that. You don't have to reopen wounds. Interestingly enough, I think the stories that really affected her was she saw a resistance fighter being hung in Auschwitz, and she spoke about that rarely. Her name was Rosa Robota, and that really affected her, as did her sister who had also died, who'd been killed. That was
in a camp.
So her sister was deported and my mother never knew where she was deported to. Originally, she was allowed to write letters home, very censored letters, and then they stopped. And I found out through my research that she was transported to a specific ghetto. And then from there, there were a minor amount of possibilities. Whether she died in a camp or whether she died in that ghetto, I'm unsure. But my mother, I think I realized in the writing of it that she not only was so sad about the sister she lost, but so sad she didn't have that relationship. I really could hear that pain of she was only 15 when her sister was deported at 26. And there was so much grief in that, in not having the understanding of what a sister could eventually be in your life.
Do you know, layers of grief. I feel as though that's something I've been thinking about a lot lately. And you think about someone like Mira and the layers of grief that somebody like that has. I was only thinking about it the other day. And I thought to myself, you know, it's just one of those things that practice never helps. Each grief is a trauma in itself. And regardless of how many times you experience it, it's as brutal as the first time, I think.
Well, I will say the postscript to her grief is that she managed to look forward and live an incredibly uplifting life where she flourished. And part of me writing that book was trying to find out, how did she get there? How did she go through an incredible trauma and come out? And it was actually one of the reasons I wrote it, because the woman I used to go for a walk with during COVID had also faced a really traumatic time, and she kept wanting to hear about my mother. And what my mother's lesson was that in times of unfathomable darkness, you really had to look for those cracks of light peering beneath. And if you couldn't find them, you had to be the light yourself with your essence. You had to actually choose to find a way out. And I really got to understand that more and more, that forward thinking that seems so impossible, you have to actually believe it is possible. Even if you can't do it in this moment, just have faith that you will be able to do it. And that, I think, made all the difference.
I think a lot of people that have come out of, that have been Holocaust survivors, not everyone, of course, but that you hear a lot of stories about resilience, about getting on with it, about, you know, trying to live the best life that they can. And not that you want to have that experience to lead you there, but it is, it does seem to be a symptom, if you like, that's probably not the right word, but of that, don't you think?
I do think there's something in that. Certainly a lot of these people didn't just survive because they were physically healthy. They had to have faith in something. And there's a story in the book where my mother arrives in concentration camp and it's the Day of Atonement where you're meant to fast. And despite getting these small rations, she nevertheless doesn't take the soup for lunch, takes the potato that's in it and puts it in her pocket. And during the day, she prays with other women. And some women who heard this were outraged. Like, who are you praying to? Why do you think there's a God? And my mother said, I had to believe that I could make a difference. And I had to believe that there was a collective good in all of us doing this. And I think that's the whole point. To me, it's a, her story is one of faith. And I don't mean religious faith. I mean faith in humanity, faith in the world, faith in a positive future. Mm. I didn't write this book so that people read it and felt depressed and felt distraught and awful. I wrote it so that it could help them in their most challenging times.
Mm. Talk to me about your research and how you found all this information and how it is that you became, you know, you had a story. Was there a lot that she had left behind that you could draw on?
So there were several testimonies she'd done, two with the Melbourne Holocaust Museum of several hours each, and then my friend, the author Elliot Perlman, had also...
Oh, I love Elliot. Yeah, nice guy.
So Elliot and I went to high school and he had re-met me years and years later and he was researching the street sweeper. Mm. When he met her, he said, I've just got to interview her more so you've got an even more expansive record. So that was another 8 hours of tremendous work. And then I had maybe quite a number of interviews I'd done with her in those last 6 months. I started with that as a beginning point, but I know as a journalist that sometimes people forget things, there are discrepancies. So on top of that, I then did everything I could to fact check. I started with the museums, the Holocaust Museum in Melbourne, the Sydney Jewish Museum, the United States Holocaust Museum and Yad Vashem in Israel. I went to the Sered Museum in Slovakia. I went to the concentration camps foundations, so Auschwitz and Plaszow and Memories of Treblinka Foundation. I searched genealogy sites and found descendants of people my mother knew and found out their stories. I had a document from my uncle who had written his story. I uncovered archives. I found at the beginning of the book there's a story about an escapee from Treblinka who becomes very important later on. And I found a testimony that no one in his family ever knew he gave that was buried in archives in Maryland in USA. So I was just really immersed in all of this.
Mm-hmm. You've written beautifully. You really have. Let me just say that this is a gorgeous book. Mira, you will love. Rochelle, thank you so much.
Cheryl, I really, as you know, I have felt very connected to you through our mothers and through our words. I know you to be a person of very great and considered reading, and I've loved learning about your mother through you.
And you too. Thank you. I was nervous about this. I was really nervous. Have you done many podcasts yet?
I have done a couple, but
good.
I mean, yours is the one that I listen to. Yours is the one that is.
Oh, thank you.
So it meant a lot to me because, I mean, it was in my head from the beginning. Like, seriously, when I started my book, I thought, do I get to go on show up? And it was when I had my first meeting with Hachette, I literally said to them, how can I get on show up? And they said, no, we'll arrange that. And I was just like so thrilled.
That is so lovely. And that's a huge compliment coming from you. I love that.
I love the way you consider books and I love, I love the writers you have on, but I can hear in your voice what you respond to. And I mean, I feel like I know you. I really want to try some of your food. I'll send you some of my mother. Hopefully the biscuits will last the distance.
Yeah. And I'll make you something. I'll make you something.
Amazing. Me and Brian Brown.
Lovely to speak with you. Come and see me. I'm so happy you're coming to Sydney.
I will. I come wear one of my t-shirts too. And then
I'll give you one. We will give you
one. I've got one already.
You are a fan.
I'm a super fan.
Thank you, lovely. Really nice to meet you. I'll see you soon.
Thank you. I really appreciate the support.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.